Welcome to another broadcast of Project Urantia on the Artist First Radio Network. An ever-growing number of people are coming to the realization that just perhaps intelligent life has been shepherding this planet for a long, long time. And with that, let's bring on, in my opinion, one person who knows just about more on that topic than anyone alive. It's Michael in Maui. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Z-Man.
Is it a burden for you to have all this, all of our listeners relying on you every week?
Oh, I don't know. I guess that's one of the missions that I was prepared for. They didn't, you know, send me back without preparation and without their help. You know, I'm talking about our celestial friends, and in particular, a group of 12 of them called the Guardians of Destiny.
You know, I was half saying that question lightheartedly to open the show, and then it sort of takes a serious tone to it when you take it on a serious... What a responsibility.
Yeah, well, it was something that, you know, I got into voluntarily without, you know, I did, you know, put my request that I would have help. I wouldn't be alone in it, and things would be timed by them. And they seem to be timed pretty darn good, you know. I mean, the way they, you know, opened my memory at the right time, and all of it being and coming in alignment with our science and, you know, with the exploration of space. That would be, in particular, Cassini's mission, which exposed the architectural sphere, grand mothership. It's actually much more than a mothership. It's huge. It's a great big city architectural sphere, and orbiting Saturn, and along with that would be nearly at this, prior to that, but very close to the timing. My memories were reinvigorated, you might, relived. It's an amazing way in which they enlivened the memory. It was amazing.
Which is bigger, the mothership or, say, New York City?
The mothership is larger.
Is there bigger cities we could... I'm sorry?
I said New York City could fit in inside. Remember, it's really a shell, like a hollow sphere, and everything is practically built on it's the shell. So inside of it is... it's like our planet turned inside out. You know, our atmosphere is outside, and we walk on the solid ground. That is the opposite way around, where the atmosphere is on the inside, and you build on the outer shell, and the outer shell grows as needed, so it's completely developed.
And it's also the most, if it's spherical, it's the most efficient use of space.
Yeah, and it's not purely spherical. It's somewhat egg-shaped. Ellipsoid.
Well, and as we approach the winter solstice of 2012, which is only now 6 months away, number of programs, you know, that are available and shows about what might be happening are, of course, exploding. If you have any questions, folks, like with any show, you're welcome to email them to us at dj@artistfirst.com. I would like to ask you, before we get into other topics tonight, while watching a couple of these shows recently, I have some questions about gravity. Would you mind taking a stab at them?
Sure.
You know, the concept of gravity, as the Celestials have mentioned on this broadcast, is that our science has it upside down, that it's a constant expansion of everything, which is a different concept than I think how science looks at gravity now. But I'm watching physicists, Akaku, on a very brilliant man, say gravity is a very weak force. Have you heard that? They say, gee, I can pick this rock up off the ground and I've defeated gravity. Have you heard those things?
Yes. Gravity is considered the weak force because the bonds of the strong force hold actually the material that, you know, the electron, neutron, you know, and various other quark stuff together in terms of the strong force. And magnetism, electromagnetism is part of the strong force. So weak force being gravity. An interesting part about gravity is it doesn't follow rules that have to do with force, energy. You know, its velocity is the same no matter what the mass is. In other words, if you drop something, it falls at the same rate. Doesn't, you know, if something drops something more massive, it doesn't have a higher velocity or increased velocity or something. A lighter part doesn't move or accelerate faster or anything. It's the same. Well, that does follow very close to the concept of an expanding great planet, expanding outward toward you, and everything would essentially be free suspended and the ground come up and meet you. So that would explain some of what goes on besides, you know, the atmosphere being pushed out, various other stronger forces interacting, you know, electromagnetic or static electricity, stuff that actually caused the accretion of matter to create the planetoids or asteroids or whatever in space that essentially created the larger groups of matter to become moons and planets and our what makes our sun up and things like that. But it's not really upside down. They actually had two definitions of gravity. They had one definition talked about as kind of like linear gravity, gravity that holds us down on the planet, and another one which they called paradise gravity, a gravity which is not responsive to linear gravity, but we become responsive to this higher gravity called paradise gravity, which sentient beings get drawn into or drawn toward. And this is one that pulls us toward divinity, toward truth, toward exploration, drives our curiosity, very energetic in terms of our developing, in terms of a civilization, in terms of developing even more intelligence and more smart, you might say. And that is the other force of gravity that they were much more concerned that I learned about than linear gravity. And the question was answered in a very simple statement. It says everything is growing bigger in terms of linear gravity, what holds us down on the planet.
Which makes perfect sense when you think, if there was a Big Bang and it exploded, why would it ever stop?
I mean, it never stopped.
Why would it? What crazy idea could we come up to rationale why the explosion would stop expanding? Of course it wouldn't. Okay, but please bear with me in my strange way of putting thoughts together regarding gravity. I guess it boils down to the interpretation of the word weak when we call gravity the weak force. Because as I conceptualize this, gravity is the strongest of all the forces. It may be pliable. Yeah, you can pick a stone up off the ground or shoot a spacecraft off of a planet. You can defeat gravity, but gravity never lets up. It holds everything, for instance, on the planet. It holds everything down. It holds the moon over there. It holds our orbit in the solar system. It holds the galaxy together, and it never breaks. You know, if gravity ever shorted out, everything would just fly off into space like particles in smoke. So I don't, maybe this is my thinking, how I rationalize this concept of gravity in my small brain. But I see it as, while yes, you can bend it, but you don't break it. And isn't it the strongest of all the forces, because it gives us the ground to walk on and the solar system to exist in and so forth?
It seems that way. However, I asked about that very line of thought. And they considered, they said something very, they always try to make it simple, because I was, you know, they knew they were talking to a simpleton, a human being, but they never considered us inferior. But they said something like, think st- static electricity. When it comes to accretion of the planetoids or mass or matter coming together to form asteroids, planetoids, or even the rings of Saturn, think static electricity. And it is static electricity is a strong force, a very strong force, and we use it quite often. However, what we've discovered recently is something that is close to akin to helping us explain gravity, but that part in which we did somewhat look at or get close to our equation was the Higgs boson, the boson side, or that little particle that just appeared for a very short period of time and had all the properties that were predicted, did not explain the full matter of what makes up reality, what makes up matter, because of all of that which is in the Higgs concept, which is what was thrown out, the ethereal, the non-material part that even helps explain and allows gravity to function. And all of these things, Michio Kaku says, are going to be part of this new exploration in discovering the fullness of the Higgs boson. Because right now, we probably just essentially got a tiny glimpse of, you know, what could be a million times more information, a million times more discoveries behind it. Because of its new opening, and included in the Higgs would be things that Higgs never thought about or wanted to acknowledge, which is all these things in which spiritual leaders and mystics and teachers of greater truth were talking about in terms of spiritual things, because that really aligns very well with his concept of what makes reality real, and it also explains gravity.
That's right. We had a couple of weeks off for vacation, and this is the first show we've had since they made the announcement of the Higgs particle discovery, or validation, shall we say. Were you surprised?
Actually, I wasn't surprised, but I knew that it was only going to be a partial discovery, because we were told it wouldn't discover the God particle in terms of its full understanding, but we'll detect it. There's so much more to understand, and that's where the arrangement which comes about. The Rancha book really describes it in a very more interesting way. It describes it as the automaton base energy, base matter, something in between, yet neutral, that needs to be, I guess, brought to reality through what Higgs was describing was somewhat ethereal, the ether, the concept of something external to it to align it together.
Well, I was glad to see the gentleman that, is it Mr. Higgs, was still alive to see his prediction come true.
At least the detection of what one part of his understanding. The other part is sort of being overlooked because it's so far out. And you think about something else being able to put matter together using sort of like somebody behind the scene with using the building blocks and putting reality together. And that's almost acknowledgement of that, but not quite being able to describe it, at least enough to say that fundamentally what mathematically was predicted would show up, and it somewhat did. It's been challenged, however, but everybody wants to believe that because there's so much more to understand behind it.
That's what I like, because you remember it was last year when Stephen Hawking said we're this close to understanding everything, and then something like this comes along, and it's like, really, you know, come on, man. I mean, isn't that the excitement too, that there's so much,
like,
that we don't know.
Really? Now we've got another door open to a much greater area of exploration that have been already explained many times by others in more simplistic ways. But we want to have, you know, something that we call rock solid, based in our own reality and physicality, and not so much just in what would be considered perhaps just thought or idea.
Well, we have talked about the moon on this broadcast, and we've talked about the fact that it doesn't spin. We always see the same side of the moon, that it's doesn't rotate in the air.
Yeah.
And certain explanations have been put forth as to why that is. And I heard another one on a program I saw, and they claim that because the moon was so close to the Earth at one point, it's getting farther every day, but because of that, the Earth's gravity stopped the moon from spinning. And in fact, they went on to say, is it a 7-foot, that the moon doesn't have tides like we think of it, but the rocks have tides. And they went on, I thought he said 7 meters, maybe it was 7 feet, but the fact that the rock actually bulges like our oceans surge in tides, but except it's a reverse effect on. So number one, do you think that's actually the case? And number two, then wouldn't this explain other moons that we know of in our solar system? Do any of them spin? Are they all captured by their host planet and locked in place? What are your thoughts?
One of my understandings is that when it came down to why is the asteroid belt there, why is our solar system looking like a disk, you know, rather than a, you know, the old atom constellation concept. Instead, it's a pancake orbiting satellites around the sun. And they said, think of that again. This is in the direct relationship of where he used the term static electricity. Now, when you look at the idea of static electricity, looking at charges and very strong forces, accretion, which is one of the most important ways in which planetoids or moons are made, has a lot to do with simply an attraction about the one with the greater attraction, greater energy will attract the smaller. The accretion process, as this mass perhaps forming a type of a ring in its initial stage, later grabbing more and more matter as it moved about, and later accreting into an actual moon with mini moons, slowly then mechanically destroying these mini moons or asteroids. And because it accreted, took a basically a single revolution, rotation, as it made one orbit, because it accreted in orbit as a disk or a ring, and as it accreted, it formed greater and greater size or mass and became essentially the moon, and the moon, as I said, mechanically, basically ran into a lot of this stuff. And, of course, other smaller things began to be attracted using this type of accretion model. And it started to, you know, bang into it. So the moon essentially formed in this way, but not without perhaps having other interferences or added material that could have piled from explosions off of the planet Earth as it literally got bombarded in itself. And then also it accreted and gathered that up too.
And you bring up an interesting point that you look at most galaxies we've discovered so far, they're flat. They're not spheres. They're disc-shaped. And most solar systems, like our solar system, seem to be flat. You know, why aren't galaxies spherical? You got, especially when you look at the...
There are some that form more nebular-type formations, or not spherical, but globular more. But there's the majority are, like you say, disc-shaped.
And you know, and why would that be? I mean, there's
because
a perfectly
one of the
good...
most fundamental things that, if you look at the way when they took, from the earliest days of atom smashing, when they could trace the particles as they tried to break up, you know, a neutron or something into a more base material, whether it be a quark or whatever it may be. They noticed that they spun. This spin is inherent in matter and its most basic form, including the Higgs boson. So spin is inherent in reality, so it makes sense that it continues from the most minute to the largest of all, which would be our galactic assembly in the universe.
That is fascinating. Exactly. I mean, the atom, the electrons, you know, they're orbiting the nucleus, and why not?
Yeah, it's all spin.
Spin
and
is
reality. Again, we are using right now in our technology today comes something called spintronics, where we are actually being able to associate the spin of a quantum particle and associate that with a on or off, so we can digitally code matter in its most minute or quantum level, and actually write or have a memory that is extremely small and stores extremely large amounts of data. So using that, we will move to quantum computing, which will use things like spintronics, and also what we're working on right now, the entanglement process. And I feel very strongly that the entanglement process of what makes matter real is part of which makes telepathy work. I remember looking at into the eyes of Nella Onisevan, who I kept looking at her and saying, how can you speak to me? Your mouth's not moving. I can hear your voice. I can see. You're calling me by my name. I hear all of that. You're talking to me. But how is this happening? And I looked and I noticed, she had a dent between her eyes somewhat, a furrow in her brow, you might say. And by the way, one of the sketches of Riley Martin shows that little dent in between her eyes. And... above her eyes, sort of on her forehead. And I was looking at that and said, maybe this is what's the energetics that's causing this, you know, much like how the Hindus, women who are married have that little red dot above, between their, or on their forehead. But she told me that's not how it works. But she also assured me, I'll begin to learn later how it works. So part of it is what I'm explaining right now.
I was going to say something stupid like Tan had domestic violence. That's hence the mark on Nella's head.
Okay.
I ain't telling. Okay, let's not go there because, of course, that's a topic that no one should make light of. I'm sorry I brought that up.
Yeah.
All right, we've got a couple emails in from some listeners. Would you mind changing direction for a moment?
Nope.
Dear Michael. This is going in a completely different direction, and it comes from Zochi, and Zochi writes, do you think the Bible is giving humans a hint, Judgment Day, Revelation chapter 20, verse 12? Now, I don't have that, and the link doesn't work to that. Gee, you were in that field for a while, weren't you?
Revelation 20, verse 12 is what is commonly called the Great White Throne Judgment. In the Great White Throne Judgment, those who are outside of aligning their souls with the divinity energy, the divinity force, the divinity truth, or what Christians commonly call being saved. Those outside of that will face a type of judgment which has to do with looking at the non-regular development of humanity or individual. That non-regular is unique. In other words, it doesn't necessarily mean that the person is living their lives purely for evil and essentially having only evil in it. They're looking in that great throne judgment for the hint that it was also moving toward paradise gravity. The individual was being motivated toward paradise gravity, but was for whatever reason, off course. Now, that concept of being off course, of course, means that there was some confusion along the process. Hence, the idea that is placed there is that these people are going to be thrown out of the unwillingly thrown out of the universe, and they'll be weeping, wailing, gnashing of teeth, and all of that, you know, terrible stuff. That sounds very much like the sounds that they got out of the deep well in Russia, you know. You ever heard that one?
Yes, I have. That's a pretty scary thing.
It sort of sounds that could be an imagination of, but there are people right now, I mean, just alive right now, who are in that state of torment. They're not judged, they just are. And for some odd reason, by the way, I did say those that are, you know, aligning themselves with the ultimate good. Jesus himself did say, you know, that he said, "Why do you call me good?" He said, you know, because he was approached. He said, "Good master, good master." He turned around and looked at him and says, "Why do you call me good? There's not, don't you know, there's none good but God." Essentially, he was pointing out that the ultimate good is really paradise gravity, being drawn to the first source and center and navigating one's life in alignment with that draw. And because of that, we may form different expressions of ourselves, but we're essentially on course. And those that are faced the great white throne are maybe those, you might say, drifters or those out of harmony. But there may be one reason or another they may be there, and that judgment will be actually done in order to be truly sympathetic with all life. He's not willing that any should fall away because of the strength of what he hopes, the divine hopes, as paradise gravity being the all-encompassing strength, while the individual retains the right to their own will and their own choosing.
I've mentioned this before. I think they've taken the program off the air because I haven't seen it for a couple of months. But on the Bio channel, that's a cable television channel, BIO, Bio, there's a program called I Survive Beyond and Back. And I'm mentioning this again because it is so freaking fascinating. It's people who sit there, and they just, the camera just focuses on them in their own words. Then they talk you through their I died experience, often called a near death experience. And of course, it's very fascinating when some of them describe not going to that fuzzy place. They describe going to a horrible place and being there for months or years in their minds, and then ultimately given a second chance. But the ones that do go to the nice place constantly mention the same few themes over and over. One is the brightest light you can possibly imagine and the biggest overwhelming amount of love you can comprehend. They struggle with words to describe the overwhelming sense of acceptance and love in this next existence. And I got to mention that from what you were talking about. Folks, if you get a chance to find that show, maybe it's available for downloads on YouTube. Just fascinating, fascinating stuff from kids from, 16-year-old kids to people in their 80s and 90s. But I just had to bring that up. Have you ever seen the program?
No, but I've spoken with a friend of mine yesterday. And while I was growing up, and young and small, I wasn't as tall as a tire on a military Jeep, little kid running around. And I would always be, held by the, cuff of the neck, don't run here, don't run here. You remember that, well, watch out for that little boy that got run over. And this little boy got run over in my hometown where I was growing up, and it's called Sprecklesville. And I met him. I didn't realize he was the one. He said, yeah, I remember Sprecklesville. I started talking about Sprecklesville, my hometown. He said, Sprecklesville, that's where I died. And I said, really? He says, yeah, I died over there. I saw the white light and everything, And I said, my mother later explained to me why she was so concerned. My mother is she was an RN. Registered nurse at the time, and worked with a physician that declared that little boy dead at the time. And she said, yeah, he looked pretty bad. She saw him, or her counterparts, other nurses, maybe at the who were with him at the hospital, saw the little boy's head somewhat. He ran over the head, exploded, and his intestines had burst out. And it was like they could cut. Basically, the life signs were gone. And what had happened was his grandmother said, that boy is not dead. And put her hand on him and said, come back, come back. And then basically he peeped his head out of the sheet, kind of like pulled the cloth down. And there he was, looking around. And, oh, my goodness, he's alive, And... I got to talk with him, and he says, yeah, I was pretty busted up. And my head was braces out, and my stomach was outside of it. Everything was beat up, but my grandma wasn't going to let me stay. And I said, oh, you are one of the examples where there is a call from this side, our side where we live, and it extends to the one on the opposite side, where the white light opposite that side. The greeter, who so many times has other people with him, but he has an immense responsibility that he can actually send souls back to be re-enlivened. And then, interesting enough, sitting right next to him was another person who grew up near or with. We had the same family. We're all associated in the same neighborhood growing up. And he said, and the other story was this guy got shot a couple of times, he was dead, said, this boy's not dead. He's not dead. And his grandmother was being told over the phone that, your grandson's dead, he got shot. He says, no, he's not dead. Let me tell you he's not dead. Doctor, you put this phone to his ear and let me talk to him. So basically said, the words were, get up, call him by name and says, get up, you're not dead, wake up, come back. And he did. Today, they're ministers. One of them is a minister. Yeah, so things happen. And the way they were living their life, the little boy was very innocent, terrible accident. It was very real. I was told about it. Got to meet him. It was a real event. And the other one was quite changed around because their lives were not in alignment. They were just basically living the life day to day for what they thought life had no meaning. So you might as well take all the good you can and go for the gusto, which ended up, becoming in the realm where, the bad guys live and, shoot guns and stuff.
Well, it is riveting. I can't believe that all these people are making it up. By the way, I got to interview Danion Brinkley. That's been probably 10 years ago, and Danion had four near-death experiences, written about it. One of the pioneers to bring this to the public's attention back in the early part of the century. And at the time I interviewed him, he had gone into hospice work after his fourth near-death experience. And at the time of our interview, he had held close to 400 individuals at the time of their death in his arms because he wanted to be there to show them this wonderful experience they were about to have. Well, anyway, so science is slowly gravitating towards, you know, hey, this is getting pretty real, especially when some of these people can tell the caregivers what was going on when they were supposedly dead. But, okay, set that aside. What about Tananella? What about, you know, the Screed? When they die, do they have similar experiences that humans do?
I can't speak for their experiences because their makeup may be different from us in terms of how their soul moves, because they have technologies that already address the soul as a transferable part, and in that transfer there is no white light. There is a movement between one body to the next, and between realizing one, basically like getting into one car to another car. You know, if you're thinking about that as a vehicle, your body as a vehicle. So we, because of going through natural death from mortal function, going through natural death, can progress through that gravity circuit, paradise gravity circuit, which pulls us through. If we're akin to that paradise gravity circuit, we'll move through to the white light, which draws and pulls. Again, that's a paradise gravity circuit. But there are those who are not aligned to it for some reason or another that will be perhaps adjusted in one way or another. And this adjustment is a mystery. Why some people are not, attuned to or responsive to the paradise gravity.
Well, I'm grossly oversimplifying this, folks, but basically, when you die, if you don't see white light, And boy, one more thing about these people who they seem to have, and regardless of which experience they had, good or bad, it seemed to profoundly change them.
Yes.
Okay, but like you said, the one person you spoke to became a minister. Several of these people went into the faith and a big time. But of course, every alcoholic's never going to drink again, so you never know. Did these people relapse? You know, be interesting to follow up years later and see if they kept those change of heart notions in their lives or whether they went back to their old ways.
Well, it's a challenge many times in just, ministry is not an easy place. It's a very, very difficult area to work with, and some of them have tremendous challenges, not necessarily with themselves, but maybe with their children. Things still are a challenge. Life is a challenge. And you can't force a person to be attuned to paradise gravity. You can introduce them to it. You can give them a taste of it. But if they turn their back on it, it's up to them. It's free will, you know.
We have an interesting email that's come in. I have to ask him. It says, "Dear Michael, please speak about your, I hope I say this right, Mitsuni Kendo Dojo Martial Arts School, where you are the senior instructor." Is that true?
Yes.
So you're not only this conduit for the aliens, you're also a badass?
Yeah. I'm descended from samurai.
No kidding.
Yes.
I had no idea. That's just the first I'd ever heard anything, and we've spent quite a few hours together. Well, do you mind telling us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, one of the interesting things is that my crest, family crest, symbolized by three commas or swirls, represents the triunity of deity, or the first source, God. And if you had God, then you had an invincibility. And one of the most important things that samurai had was no fear of death. But how they got it was the realization of the movement of the soul. The soul and the samurai sword were given the same relationship. It said, oh, the samurai soul was his sword, but it really is only, the soul was only a badge of the reality of the soul. So samurai, a long time ago, knew of this, and it was taught this. And my roots trace back to the Middle East, toward archaic group of the lost tribes of Israel. So, but in the tradition of what I, you know, try to express is to have what would be called Morancho Mota, the higher characteristics that are passed on in life into the next that we can keep with us. We can't take with us wealth, but we can take with us the discipline of life. We can take with us the richness, great wealth of character that can be developed through training, meditation, and all of these things that bring about truly divine character. This was an important factor that samurai were supposed to nurture, because they had to write that if anyone was disrespectful or a threat or to something, basically they could cut their heads off without, you know, without a blink. But we're having this tremendous power of a person's life required almost a divine type of role. You almost had to train oneself to become truly compassionate, truly divine, and have true control over animal instincts. And it takes a lot of training sometimes, and much of it was beaten out of us as youth. Sort of like wrestling years, you know, you're talking about wrestling, getting pinned a whole lot of times by the coach, you know. And okay, you know, don't think of yourself too highly now.
Are your students scared to death of you?
No. I never pushed anything on them, but the basics, you know. So
now, come on.
But there's a couple of students now that are, one of them especially, that has become very special in terms of her alignment and how she was sent. It's a she. So.
Well, I don't know anything about martial arts school, but I imagine sometimes there's sparring, and sometimes you know, like in football, you get tackled. It hurts sometimes. Is there similar things in what you do?
Well, you know, we essentially, Japanese kendo is a fencing art, and we do get struck. The one who gets struck in the beginning, of course, is the teacher. The teacher allows himself to get beaten by the student, and in that preparation, the student will learn a great amount first, respectfully beating up your instructor correctly. In other words, you know, learning how to behave oneself, not just going out there and swinging wildly, but things about, you know, this is being offered to you. I am offering you myself. Learn well. Concept. These are the things that are essentially divine in character, because God essentially is giving you part of his reality, and he says, my children, learn well. Here, strike me now. And this is how we teach.
And there's no accumulation at the end of the semester where you break out the can of whoop-ass and I'm tired of you beating on me, Billy, and you show them how the things are done.
Well, it happens. What happens usually is that they gain a certain amount of ability, and they try it out among themselves in, you know, equal types of practice, you know, or competition. And if they haven't mastered their character, sometimes they, you know, we know that as poor sportsmanship and things like that. They gotta, you know, get a hold of themselves sometimes. And this is all part of the development process. And it's a long, hard, rigorous process to get high in rank, especially to the eighth degree, which is almost impossible to do. And you're supposed to have mastered all things concerning basically the martial art, but oneself, having actually nurtured oneself or developed oneself more toward perfecting one's character.
Well, Michael, you never cease to amaze me. This is thank you, Matt in Orville, for sending that in. This, we're discovering more fascinating things about Michael in Maui. Maybe school enrollment will go up.
Yeah, well, maybe that, or nobody will come at all.
Now, you know, let's face it. Now, you've spoken of, and so had Riley Martin, about how the Celestials have to be kind of careful because they're kind of frail. I don't mean the Celestials in, like, you know, the Danels, but, you know, the Beavians. They're kind of scrawny, the Greys. They, you know, most robust humans could take them, and especially a master in Kendo. You know, you're a deadly force just waiting to happen.
Yeah, perhaps, you know, but that's not what they saw. In fact, I wasn't only taken to be with them back in 72. There have been other occasions, and in one occasion, I think it was more recent, one of them said, will you be come, when you come here, will you bring that Kendo with you? And I says, you want to learn, you little guy, you want to learn that stuff? And he said, yeah, here, isn't this good enough? And he had in his hand a bamboo sword, which is called a shinai. And I said, where did you get that? And he says, from your earth? And it's not the first time they went over there and collected something. But I think, my goodness, these guys want some of what we do, you know. So we might be sharing stuff like that one day.
Yeah, you gotta
some of our culture, and it's interesting to them, and they want to try it out.
I think that's why they started QVC, so you can buy all those swords and things they have on above Tan's mantle. He's got a couple of those from QVC. Well, you know, all kidding aside, like you say, a samurai could kill the person standing next to him in 1 second if he felt like it, as opposed to just somebody like me. I'm just a regular guy. I don't have any karate moves. I just, you know, grapple with the rest of them. I'm much less of a threat than someone like you. Well, Michael, we continue to find fascinating things out about you, as we have since we started this broadcast. We have about 4 minutes left. And before I run out of time, as usual, I would like to say that you do this program because you told your Celestial friends you would do something. And we are grateful that you use this platform that's the something that you use. And among other things, like broadcasturancha.com, and you're on with Curtis. There's lots of places you can find out about Michael. There's lots of information. We are no way trying to corner anything. We're trying to help get the word out there. Michael does not get paid, and Michael has nothing to sell. But you certainly receive the admiration and thanks of all of our listeners for all of the hours that you give us over the year, and we are deeply indebted to you.
Well, certainly welcome to, you know, this, what I have, because it was something that I was supposed to share, but at the right time, and the time, I guess, is now. And it's a very special year also.
Well, we've gotten a couple emails that want to know the address of your dojo. I'm not sure we're going to give that out on the program, how you guys found out about this in the first place. Just keep on that path.
Just
we got to
Google
have,
it. Yeah,
we got to show Michael a bit of privacy. We, you know, he does this out of the graciousness of his heart, like we talked. And let's not become creepy around him, okay, listeners? Let's be respectful. And, Michael, thank you very much. I look forward to our next visit, and stay well, and we'll see you a week from tonight.
Yes, indeed. And aloha.